What was the office like in 1960? You reckon you can probably find out by watching a couple of television programs that look at office culture from those eras, things like Mad Men on, I think it's on SBS, and The Hour, which is just finished on the ABC, looking at that kind of era. But what about today? How has the office changed? Well, I came across an article in the paper on the weekend talking about the art of spotting and managing office pests, and referred to things like narcissist, the socialised psychopath, the egomaniac, the bully, the sleaze. We've all come across them, haven't we? How do we deal with that? Well, somebody has written a book about it. Her name is Leanne Faraday-Brash, and she's an organisational psychologist. Good morning.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
As far as writing a book about something like this, I mean, is this something you've studied all your life?
I think that all of us are psychologists, and we've all studied and graduated from the University of Life, even if we don't have professional qualifications. But I certainly have always been intrigued with people and what makes them tick, and why as adults do we do some of the things we do, and how might that relate to things that have happened to us in our lives, and the models and the imprints that we've seen that mean that when we grow up, we don't necessarily act all the time quite as maturely and emotionally intelligently as perhaps we should as a reflection of our age. But I was really inspired to write the book probably about 3 years ago, having consulted so heavily in the areas of discrimination, harassment, workplace justice and bullying. But it was only when I learned about the tragic death of young Brodie Panlock, who was systemically and pervasively bullied in her workplace in Victoria and then ultimately suicided, that I thought I really need to write this book. And if it helps one organisation sit up and listen and do some things differently, or one manager take stock, then it will have been worth it.
Now, your media release actually says the new book is to stop dastardly deeds in the workplace. I mean, do you think you really can?
Well, you only can if you've got strong commitment from senior people who've got enough authority to do something about it, and or if you get the people below them actually writing. I've certainly seen situations where you've got a manager who has avoided detection. They're either brilliant at managing upwards and the executive think they're wonderful, or the client thinks they're great, or the organisation is just impotent in doing something about them. And if staff then come together and say, at the risk of whatever may happen, we all need to go en masse to someone senior and say that we just can't work for this person anymore, what they're encouraging us to do, the unethical behaviour or the irrational outbursts are just unacceptable. And if it's enough people and they are good people, hardworking people and are otherwise honest and responsible, then an organisation might realise. Often what happens, though, is they realise once it's too late and a whole lot of talented people have left in disgust because they're willing to carry the individual who, for whatever reason, has some redeeming features that mean they're protected.
Now, does this only happen in large organisations, or can it happen in the small ones as well?
No, it can certainly happen in small ones, and often if they're small ones where you've got one owner and a couple of staff working for them, possibly even very young staff who aren't assertive and don't necessarily know their rights, some pretty horrible things can happen in very small organisations. A few years ago, there was a spate of horrible sexual harassment complaints made about people working in chicken shops. So I don't know whether it was rotisserie chickens or all those chicken breasts lying around, but somehow you just had people who probably think that they can avoid detection and have people working with them who are vulnerable to being sacked, who really need the money and may be prepared to put up and shut up rather than do something about it.
So who actually recognises these things? Does it have to wait till a complaint arrives?
I actually think the best organisations are ones where someone is responsive as soon as someone sends up a flare, even if it's informal, and says, I'm really bothered by the way I'm being treated, or I've been asked to do something that I feel intensely uncomfortable about. I'm not sure that it's ethical or even legal. If they send up a flare and someone takes it seriously immediately, they don't need to put in a formal complaint. And then when you don't have the angst of the formal investigation, no one has to make any findings, lawyers don't have to be called in, we don't have to go to an external jurisdiction. It is simply an organisation that says, we may be too big and too complex to know everything that's going on, but when someone brings something to our attention, we won't assume guilt, but we'll listen to both parties, try to determine what happened, and then make the most appropriate decision. So the very best organisations I work with aren't ones where nothing happens, because you don't want people walking around in a bubble scared to say boo to anybody, but they're the ones that really are committed to doing something about an issue once it comes to their attention.
Is there a sort of natural tendency to sweep things under the carpet and just hope they'll go away?
There can be for some managers. Some managers are really task-focused and they're not really tuned into the people stuff. Some of them are worried that if they try to deal with it, they'll botch it up. Sometimes they've gone to parenting school and learnt that if there's squabbles between the kids, the best thing the parent can do, unless there's a threat of physical violence, is just to stay out of it. And some of us are naturally avoidant around conflict, or managers might actually be intimidated by one or both parties and not want to take them on.
Now, what's the worst example you've ever seen?
I think probably the most bleak and black environment I ever saw was a food manufacturing environment in the western suburbs in Melbourne. Obviously, I won't name them. And it had been a family business, and I think the family members had been really quite happy over a long period of time to give workers amazing lurks and perks. Whenever there was any hint of conflict, they would throw more money at them. The union on that site was extremely powerful and, unfortunately, in this instance, not very constructive, so that just about everybody who worked there who wanted to call it a day when they got older would actually never resign. They would go off on work cover or they would go out on stress, and the union would be absolutely duplicitous in that. They said no one should ever have to leave here without a big packet of money. And the culture got so bad and toxic that when the organisation was bought, the new owners said, we're never going to be able to write this with all the people who are still here. And they actually closed down that site and all of those people lost their jobs.
Now, you raise an interesting point there about unions. Now, you've talked about managers not being necessarily willing to face the problem. What about individuals who seem to think that maybe it's not my problem to sort out my problem? I need to refer it to someone else to sort it out for me.
Yes, it's a good point. Unions play a very important representative role, and I think in lots of ways you get the union you deserve on site. If you are responsive, if you're respectful of your people, if you treat them well, then the union will be or should be a trusted partner. Now, sometimes there are other agendas running and the unions have to continue to demonstrate their relevance in organisations. So sometimes you'll see an enthusiastic or over-enthusiastic union delegate making a storm in a teacup. But generally, if you treat your people well, you don't expect the unions to engage in too much argy-bargy. It is unfortunate, though, when there is so little trust between unions and management that rather than trust managers to do the right thing, the union will come in on the front foot, be very antagonistic, and whip the employee up into a frenzy when maybe the issue could have been dealt with in a much calmer, more respectful, low-key way, and then there's a better chance that the relationship will be maintained and people can then continue to work together once the issue around the bullying or the harassment or the unwelcome attention has been sorted.
Okay, and finally, Leanne, why Vulture Cultures as a title?
Well, there have been lots of books written about the individual sociopath or the snake in suits or the problem child, and I really wanted to underscore the idea that in this book, any of these individuals can wreak havoc, but they don't do so unless someone or someones in the organisation actually condone or incentivise or justify or turn a blind eye to that behaviour. So it's a vulture culture, not because one person is doing something that's really distressing or offensive to someone else. It's because there are other people around them who aren't doing anything about it, and that says something about the culture that's not healthy.
Very interesting. Let's hope the book changes the culture of some organisations. Leanne, thank you very much for talking to us.
Pleasure, Chris.
That was Leanne Faraday-Brash, an organisational psychologist, and she's written this book called Vulture Cultures, a new book to stop dastardly deeds in the workplace. Let's hope maybe it will do so.